love it. It's something my dad started years ago, and it's perhaps why it's been such a resurgence is the availability of the internet, right? And how easy it is to research things now, right? You have services like 23andMe and Ancestry DNA, and they have people around the world finding new relatives and discovering their full ethnic identities. That's pretty amazing, right? To get to see where you come from, like what parts of the world do you have in you, right? In fact, Mel and I just sent out to see what our ancestry is, a month ago, and we're waiting to hear back. So hopefully I'll find out I'm half Mexican, and that's why I love Mexican food so much, but I doubt it. But I'm holding out hope. But this morning, Matthew begins his gospel, and thus the beginning of the Christmas story, with a list of names, okay? See, this is the part of the Bible that we most likely skip over when we're reading through the Christmas story, right? It's not our favorite part of the Christmas story, is it? It's kind of dull. It's a lot of names, but that's where we're going to begin today. In fact, I wouldn't think about doing a sermon on a bunch of list of names. It doesn't really appeal to me, but that's what we're going to do this morning. So hold on. See, Matthew didn't put this list here in Matthew 1. So if you want to turn there, we're going to be in Matthew 1. He didn't put this list in there because he needed to pad his pages of his book, right? He wasn't trying to add an extra page to meet a page number count for his editor, right? That's not what he was doing. What he's doing here, church, is he's making a bold statement about who Jesus is, okay? And that's where we're going to begin this morning. So Matthew opens up his gospel by making an audacious claim. So verse 1, join me there, it says this: "This is the record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham." See, Matthew's telling us here that this traveling rabbi from Nazareth who was arrested on false claims, false charges, and was executed by the Romans is the rightful heir to the throne of David and thus the promised son of God. That's what Matthew's doing in this first line of his gospel. He begins first by mentioning two important names. Jesus, he says, is the son of David and the son of Abraham. Well, why in the world do those two names matter? Why do these specific two individuals have such significance? Well, to fully understand this, we're going to have to jump back in time to Genesis. You don't have to turn there. I'll have the scriptures that I use on the screen, but you see, when God called Abraham to leave his family and everything familiar and to go to a place that he didn't know, this wasn't because God was interested in Abraham becoming a wandering man. That wasn't what he was trying to accomplish. See, God was doing something with Abraham. From this once pagan man would come a family, and from this family, a whole nation. This is what God promised him numerous times. And it's in from Genesis 12, 1 through 3, he says this: "Now the Lord said to Abraham, 'Go out from your country, your relatives, and your father's household to the land that I will show you. Then I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. And I will make your name great, so that you will exemplify divine blessing. I will bless those who bless you, but the one who treats you lightly I must curse, so that all the families of the earth may receive blessing through you.'" Then, a couple chapters later in 15:5, it says this: "The Lord took him outside and said, 'Gaze into the sky and count the stars. If you are able to count them,' then he said to him, 'So will your descendants be.'" You see, it was incomprehensible at the time for Abraham to ponder how in the world God was going to make from his family a nation, right? It's hard for us to imagine that. Well, he's just one person. How in the world is it possible for this to happen? And yet this promise was repeated to Isaac, to Jacob, and to all the generations of the people of Israel. Okay, that's why Abraham is important, because he was the start of God's promise. Later in Israel's history, God would pluck another man from obscurity and make an even bigger, seemingly impossible promise to him. Here he urged Samuel to find David from the shepherd fields and anoint him as Israel's next king, right? And when David finally assumed the throne of Israel, God said he would preserve the throne of David forever, right? In fact, 2 Samuel 7:12 through 16 says this: "When the time comes for you to die, I will raise up your descendant, one of your own sons, to succeed you, and I will establish his kingdom. I will build a house for my name, and I will make his dynasty permanent. I will become his father, and he will become my son. When he sins, I will correct him in the rod of men and with wounds inflicted by human beings." Then he goes on and says, "But my loyal love will not be removed from him as I removed it from Saul, whom I removed from before you. Your house and your kingdom will stand before me permanently. Your dynasty will be permanent." See, God is promising David what? He's promising David a kingdom forever. Think about how this must have sounded to David, right? Sure, as any great monarch would, he wanted his son to reign after him, and he would want his son to reign after him, and so on and so on and so on, right? But even the most narcissistic rulers who hear, "Oh, king, live forever," don't usually believe it. How do you ensure that your family line continues on forever? How do you ensure that? But this was not an overstatement. You see, God really meant it, and he renewed this promise even after the kingdom of Israel was divided and conquered, and centuries after David died and was buried. He still had the promise. I want to share one of these promises with you in Ezekiel 34. Verse 23 through 24 says this. It says, "I will set one shepherd over them, and he will feed them, namely my servant David. He will feed them and will be their shepherd. I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David will be prince among them. I, the Lord, have spoken." Right? This is a promise about the lineage of David, about forever, right? And this is just one example. And if you take some time to read through the prophets, you'll see David's name come up multiple times, over and over again. And a lot of the times, they're not referring to him in the past tense, but they're referring to him as if he's part of the future of God's redemptive plan, okay? I encourage you to look up some of the prophets and read through them. They're a great tool to strengthen your faith. I'm going to share one more of these promises with you this morning. In Jeremiah 23:5, he gave this hope that a new David would come. I'll read that. It says, "I, the Lord, promise that a new time will certainly come when I will raise up for them a righteous branch, a descendant of David. He will rule over them with wisdom and understanding and will do what is just and right in the land." You see, Matthew here is asserting here in his gospel with his opening list of hard-to-pronounce names, okay, that this day has come. The day has finally come. Matthew is saying that Jesus, is the fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham, and Jesus is the new David promised by the prophets. See, in this genealogy, Matthew traces Jesus' legal right to the throne of Israel through Joseph's line. right? We see that. In Luke, we see Jesus' lineage traced through, if you didn't know this, traced through Mary's line. Both families come from the family of David. Joseph from Solomon's family and Mary from David's son Nathan. But Matthew is making the case that Jesus is the fulfillment of the promise to David, right? In fact, even the way he arranges the list of names is significant. So I'll get to this confusing equation. I know, kids, that's probably not what you get when you time 14 times 3, but bear with me. He arranges the list of names in a significant way. It's something we don't always pick up on when we read our English translations of the Bible, right? That's the downside of how things have translated. Not everything comes across like it's supposed to, or we don't pick up on the things exactly like they were. I want you to notice what he's doing here. In verse 17, when he divides his list into three lists of 14 generations. Let's read that together in Matthew 1:17. It says this, "So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations. And from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations. And from the deportation to Babylon to Christ, 14 generations." So you got Abraham to David, right? David until exile to Babylon. And the exile until Jesus himself. Matthew didn't include every single generation from Adam to Jesus like Luke did in his genealogy. Instead, Matthew used 14 generations three times, and he had a specific purpose for doing so. You see, the Hebrew language, they had a device called gematria. Did I say that right? You say it. Gematria. So this device, it used letters. It was represented by numbers. So every letter had a number except for vowels, apparently. So the consonants in every Hebrew word would add up to a number. So David's name, that's smaller than I thought it was going to be, adds up to the number 14. You got D equaled 6, or D equaled 4, V equals 6, and D equaled 4, which equals 14. Isn't that interesting? That's neat, right? See, Matthew, the person I believe he was, deliberately did this, repeated this three times, as if to emphasize that Jesus was the new David. And what's more interesting, David's name appears as the 14th name in the genealogy list, as the descendant list. I think that's very interesting, right? Matthew's not trying to be cute here, okay, church? He's not trying to be neat and try to be trendy or anything like that. He was deliberately creating a way for faithful Jewish people to easily remember that Jesus Christ was the son of David, right? They all would have been familiar with this device that they used, right? That would have been a normal part of their society, associating names with numbers, and that's what he was doing here. And it's not just that he's the son of David, any son of David, right? Because plenty of men came along who had the right family heritage, but Matthew says that Jesus is the Christ. And you know the title Christ means Messiah or anointed one. Jesus, the son of Abraham, the son of David, the Christ. That's what Matthew is setting and embedding into the minds of the Jewish community here. So why is this important? Why is this that Jesus is the son of Abraham, the son of David, the Christ? Why is that so important? It's because, church, that everything that we celebrate at Christmas, it hinges on that fact. It hinges that he is through the line of David, through the line of Abraham. You see, if this baby born in Bethlehem to peasant parents who lived a perfectly sinless life, went to die on a Roman cross, and rose again on the third day, is indeed the Christ, then it changes everything. It means, church, that Christmas is more than Hallmark movies and trips to grandma's house, right? It does. It's definitely more than Hallmark movies, but that's besides the point. You see, it's the celebration of the birth of the Son of God. It's the celebration of the long-promised Messiah. It's the inbreaking of the kingdom of God. That's why it's important for us not to get caught up simply in the sentimentality of Christmas without realizing what it is that we are celebrating in the first place. Because guess what? It's so easy to get caught up in the sentimentality or in Christmas without thinking about what Jesus did for us. It's easy. And our culture makes it easy for us to do that. That's where we have to stand firm. Someone shared this true statement. I don't have it on. I'll just read it to you. They said, sadly, in the name of tradition and good tiding, Christians can have all the comforts of the Christmas season without being confronted with their need to follow the very one whose birth they acknowledge. That's the state that we're in, church. We can enjoy all the comforts of what Christmas means without believing in the one who Christmas is named after. You see, it should be Christians who should be responding to Christmas year-round if we really do believe the words of the carols and the world-altering significance of the nativity story, right? And what that means. This really is the answer to the question, what does Christmas mean for me? That's what should define what Christmas really means to me. Because if you are in Jesus, then the story of Adam to Abraham, from David to Christ, that's your story too. We are part of that family, right? And if you're not a follower of Jesus, if you've not repented of your sins and you put your faith in Jesus and his death and the resurrection, that can be your story, right? And that's the beauty of it. It can be your story too. Of course, by now, as you've looked at Jesus' family tree, I know I didn't read it, right? It's boring. Who wants to read through all those names? But I'm going to read through some of them. By now that you've looked at Jesus' family tree outlined in Matthew and Luke, you may have a few questions, right? It's a little bit of a messy-looking family. And let me share some of that. Of course, it's awesome that Jesus is the new David, the son of Abraham, the promised Messiah. But what are all of these misfits doing here? Okay? David, for example. Sure, he was Israel's best king. But isn't he the one who committed adultery and arranged for his mistress's husband to be killed? Right? Abraham, what about him? Sure, he went out on faith, but didn't he lie about his wife multiple times? Didn't he have a child with his handmaiden? Then there's all the sons of Jacob. Out of all the sons of Jacob, did Jesus have to come from Judah's line? Out of all the other sons he could have come from. Well, have you read about Judah? You know what he did? First off, he sold his brother Joseph to traffickers. Okay, not a good start. And then he had relations with his daughter-in-law, right? You see, if you signed up for Ancestry DNA, hopefully this doesn't happen, Mel. It'll probably be on your side, though. And found out of all these people who were in your family tree, right? I don't know that you'd want to tell anybody, right? It's not like, hey, honey, guess what? I just found out I'm related to a lying adulterer and a murderer. Yeah, that's not something we'd go out and spread, right? But that's what Jesus is doing here. It'd be like discovering you were the great-grandson of the Boston Strangler or Benedict Arnold's long-lost fourth cousin, right? It's not something, it's not the kind of people that you would tell people about, but the kind of people Jesus has in his family tree, they are infamous. We remember them, right? They're not the kind of characters that you put on your fridge, right? That Christmas card from that weird uncle, okay? You don't put that on their fridge. And yet, church, in this list of names is another countercultural message. And that's that these are the kinds of people who make up the family of God. Jesus' kingdom is a place where the last in line when it comes to holiness would be first, and where sinners of this world would find refuge. That's the kind of family that Jesus has. And guess what? This is good news for us, right? Because though we may pretend, especially during this time of year, to have it all together, we know that there are parts of our lives that we'd rather not see exposed to the light of day, right? There are parts of our lives that we like having known to just us and our spouse, probably, right? None of us are perfect. We all have sin in our lives. You see, in his genealogy, Jesus is telling us the kinds of people who are eligible for his gospel. And that's everybody. You don't have to be perfect. You don't have to live a great life. You don't have to be high-class society. You can be anybody. Late author Tim Keller says this. He said, "The world has always despised people from the wrong places and with the wrong credentials. We are always trying to justify ourselves. We need desperately to feel superior to others, and everything about Jesus contradicts an opposed that impulse." See, Jesus has come for outsiders and for sinners. The majority of his ministry that we've seen so far going through the book of Matthew, he spent with the outsiders and the sinners. He's come for the downcast and the powerless. Church, in a way, in a word, he's come for you and me. That's who he's come for. I like to highlight four characters from Jesus' family tree that truly illustrate the upside down nature of the kingdom of God. And all of them are women, which is remarkable in and of itself, because typically Jewish genealogies wouldn't even include women. That would have been a big no-no, right? They only ever listed men as the heads of their household. Women in the ancient world had little agency and had vitally no voice, okay? So in telling the Christmas story through women like Mary and Elizabeth and Anna, Jesus is telling us that his kingdom is a different kind of kingdom, right? And even in the small, seemingly insignificant detail of listing four women in Jesus' family tree, Matthew is communicating something powerful. And there's more than four women. I'm only sharing four of them. In fact, it would be scandalous for Matthew to put these women's names in his account in the first place. And guess what? That's what he did. So, now, these four women I'm going to talk about, they're not just any women. They're not the Marys and the Elizabeths, right? Each one of them carried with them a stigma, an asterisk per se, okay, next to their name every time a faithful Jewish person had to hear their name read out in the temple or in the synagogue, okay? So think about that. And the first one is the forgotten. Let's read Matthew 1:3. It says this: "Judah, the father of Perez, and Zerah by Tamar." We'll stop there. Tamar. Tamar is the name most Jewish people likely wanted to forget about, right? And guess what? Here she is. She is first mentioned in Genesis 38, where she was the wife of a man named one of two sons of Judah. You see, these sons were the result of adulterous relationship in the first place that Judah had with another Canaanite woman. Was not a good husband and was killed by God. When he died, it was according to custom that the time for the brother to take on the wife of the man who died, the next older brother, and his name was Onan, whatever you want to, and he married Tamar and continued the family line. That was custom. But in a greedy attempt to set himself up for a richer inheritance, he refused to conceive and have a baby with Tamar. And as a result, God struck Onan dead as well. Well, the next brother was much younger, so Tamar waited and waited for Judah to give his youngest son as her husband. And well, guess what? This never happened. Okay? See, Judah was reluctant, believing that Tamar was somehow cursed by God. I mean, two of his sons had already died who were married to her, right? He was reluctant. So she took things into her own hands and dressed up like a prostitute along the main roadway. And Judah propositioned her. And as a result of their time, they conceived, right? And one of their two sons, let's be clear, I guess one of two sons, Perez, would be ancestor of King David and eventually to King Jesus, right? You see, Judah and Tamar's place in the family of Jesus, it shows us a kind of interesting association between the powerful and the powerless. You got Judah on one hand, who was the hypocritical leader who covered his sin and who exploited his daughter-in-law to satisfy his passion. Then you got Tamar, who was helpless and forgotten. In Jesus' new family church, both the religious hypocrite and the exploited mistress find their need for grace. Next, we have the sinful. Matthew 1:5 says this: Solomon, the father of Boaz, by Rahab. So Rahab's story is a little similar to Tamar's in a way. Of course, we know that Rahab was the person who hid the Jewish spies as they came out to scout the land, right? The land of Jericho. And she hid them in her home and protected them from the prying eyes of the government, police, or whoever you want to call them in Jericho. And she heard of the miracles that God had wrought with Israel in Egypt in the wilderness. And unlike the rest of her country, she turned to faith in Yahweh. But her fresh profession, Joshua tells us, was that of a prostitute. We recoil, don't we? We don't even like to hear it, right? We don't like that word. But that was often the profession of a woman back in that day who had no family or no husband. That was one of the only ways she could make a living. Doesn't condone what she did, but That was the truth of the matter. But because she proved critical intelligence, provided critical intelligence that helped Israel defeat Jericho, she was given safe harbor in Israel and grafted into the Jewish nation. James 2:25 says this: And similarly, was not Rahab the prostitute also justified by works when she was welcomed? When she welcomed the messengers and sent them out by another way? You see, Rahab's life is evidence that Jesus is always bringing in outsiders. She was not Jewish. She was brought in, right? Though seen by religious institutions as too damaged by sin, she was seen, would have been seen as someone who was too damaged by sin to be part of the people of Israel. But she was brought in. And as we gather church this Christmas to worship, we are tempted to think of ourselves as more righteous than Rahab, than the Rahabs of our world. But in a sense, every human being is as clean as is as unclean in God's eyes as she is to us. Paul, who was once an observant, faithful Jew, recognized that there is none righteous before God and saw himself as the chief of sinners. Paul. That was Paul. But the good news is that Jesus, by his life and his death and resurrection, is bringing the Rahabs of our world into his family, into his new family. Right? That's what he's doing. The third one I want to point out is the exploited. Matthew 1, 6b says this. David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah. Well, the wife of Uriah's name was Bathsheba. We probably don't need any introduction to Bathsheba's story, but I'll give a little bit. We all know what happened when King David looked down from his rooftop and saw Bathsheba. It was the biggest scandal during the reign of the greatest king of Israel, right? And most of us think this story in terms of what it means for David. Often it's used as a sloppy apologetic for our own sin. For example, oh, David sinned and still was a man after God's own heart. Or David was repentant, so when we are repentant, we will find grace as well. Or God still used David as a leader after his sin, which is, there's truth in that. But what about Bathsheba's story? What about her? Let's think about Bathsheba for a moment. You see, the Bible never really seems to bring judgment on her for her place in David's life, right? It's likely that when David summoned her from her home, she had little choice but to comply. If you are a woman in the ancient world and the king summons you, you obey, right? See, Bathsheba's life was one of difficulty and sorrow. She was likely unpopular, even despised by the women in Israel and even in David's family because of who she was. She suffered the loss of a son and became the wife of an unfaithful husband. And yet, here she appears in Matthew's retelling of the story of Israel and the promise of the Redeemer. She is named by God a victim of exploitation, church. That's who Jesus, God, used. And so it is that God sees and knows all of those who are often exploited and abused. See, in Jesus, the forgotten can find a new family and a new identity. And the last one we're going to look at is the outsider. We're going to pick up in verse 5 of Matthew 1, about middle. This is Boaz, the father of Obed, by Ruth. Perhaps out of all the names listed, at least the female names listed here, the most scandalous name in Jesus' genealogy would be Ruth. And you may be like, oh, why Ruth? I don't feel like she did very much. She wasn't that bad, right? But you see, unlike the other three women, she doesn't have the same backstory and she isn't the victim of abuse. And yet to the Jewish person hearing Matthew's account, her appearance would be completely offensive to them. Well, why is that? Well, like Rahab, Ruth wasn't Jewish, so she has that in common. But you see, not only was Ruth not Jewish, she was also a Moabite. And Moabites were not simply Gentiles. They were one of Israel's sworn enemies, okay? They weren't even allowed to enter the worship gathering of Israel. They were idolaters who had refused to help Israel as they made their way from Egypt. Okay? She would have, they would never even want to mention her name knowing who she's descended of. And Ruth's life was one of difficulty and sorrow. She saw her husband, her brother-in-law, and her father-in-law all perish in Moab. And when Naomi, her mother-in-law, sought to return to home, Ruth chose to follow her and worship Naomi's God. And she eventually became the wife of Boaz and the great-grandmother of King David. And the book of Ruth beautifully tells the story of Boaz and Ruth's kinsman's redeemer, the one with power and resources to rescue and protect the vulnerable. You ever want to read Ruth? That's great. And her appearance here in the opening pages of Christmas reminds us that Jesus is the redeemer of those who are on the outside, who, like the Moabites, Ruth were once alien to the courts of the Almighty and are now brought in as full participants of the grace of God. Right? That's what this genealogy says about us. That's what it stands out for. To show the importance of who Jesus came from and the important people in his life. And hopefully by now, you will never read the first chapter of Matthew the same way. You'll think of these people, this name that's mentioned one or two times, or like Bathsheba is not even mentioned, just his wife, right? You'll think of them. But more importantly, I hope that you understand that Jesus is more than just a name in the Bible. You see, church, he's the son of Abraham. He's the son of David. He is the Christ. And I find it comforting that God names these four otherwise forgotten, otherwise outsider women. He names the exploited, the forgotten, otherwise outside women. He names the exploited, the forgotten, the powerless, right? He's naming those people that we wouldn't consider to think about. And the world may forget your name, but you can be known and named by the one who is the name that is above every name, church. And that's what we need to stand on. And what's more, guess what? Jesus can give you a new name. Did you know that? This is the real meaning of Christmas, that God is in the business of taking sinners like you and me, church, and making us new creations with new identities and a new purpose, right? The old has passed away, the new has come. Let's be reminded of this truth. And I want to share 2 Corinthians 5:17-19. I have it on the screen. So then, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. What is old has passed away. Look, what is new has come. And all these things are from God who reconciled us to himself through Christ, and who has given us the ministry of reconciliation. In other words, in Christ, God was reconciling the world to himself, not counting people's trespasses against them, and he has given us the message of reconciliation. See, church, I hope that you understand that if there's room in the family of God for Rahab and Tamar, Abraham and Jacob, Ruth and Bathsheba, David and Judah, guess what? There's room for you. There is room for you. I want to close with a video we're going to watch. It's a music video. It has nothing to do with Christmas, but we're going to watch that, and then I'll say a few words and close this in prayer.